This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the stage of history.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Welcome to the Dreamcast Junkyard DreamPod episode 126. I am once again joined with Lewis. Hello, Lewis.
Hello.
It feels like it's been a long time since we've teamed up on any type of Dreamcast project that the audience has seen, at least, whilst we're always talking and churning away in the cogs behind the main site. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I've just been plugging away at the top 200, which we'll get on to, which obviously you put a lot of effort into submitting blurbs for. So, but we'll get back to that.
Yeah. I feel that was my true baptism of fire as a blog writer. We are very lucky today that we are joined by a very special guest, which is Nick Thorpe. Hello, Nick. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you. How are you guys today?
Yeah, we are very good. For just to give Nick a proper introduction, for anyone who doesn't know Nick, he is a features writer for the superb Retro Gamer magazine. Have I got your title right there, Nick?
Features editor is my official job title.
Features, features editor. Okay, sorry about that. Feel free to call me Ken for the next 5 minutes in payback. So the features editor for the Retro Gamer magazine, and I'm just going to come out. I've been nervous about this since you've been coming on, Nick. I have a bit of a confession here. Sometime in the last month, I have just traded in about 150 copies of Retro Gamer because I just didn't have space for them anymore in the house. And I'm like, oh, what if he knows this somehow? What if someone stole him? So I had a choice between GamesTM, Edge, and Retro Gamer, and I've kept GamesTM. I'm sorry to say. So if you want to call me Ken for 10 minutes, please feel free to do so.
I mean, no worries. I've written for all three of them. So,
oh, there we go. So I've redeemed myself with that.
You dodged a bullet there, Kev.
Dodged a bullet. Yeah. So GamesTM and Retro Gamer are probably my two favorite games magazines, possibly along with the Sega Saturn magazine, which having alienated you, alienated Lewis, I've now alienated our Dreamcast audience by not mentioning a Dreamcast magazine. Right. Anyway, moving on, Nick is here to talk about Retro Gamer issue 254 with us. Do you want to give it a bit of a better billing than I would be able to, Nick? Why is our audience going to like 254?
So issue 254, we have a special feature. It's a cover feature on the Dreamcast 25th anniversary. Obviously, we're slightly behind the actual date, but that's the way that print goes. So we have a 12-page cover feature talking about not only the history of the system and its sort of brief commercial lifespan, but also talking about the effort that fans put in today to keep the system alive. Yeah, I've got plenty of interviewees. Should hopefully be a pleasant read for everybody.
Yeah, definitely. So I know myself, Lewis, and possibly when they find out about this, our Discord in our community is going to be rushing out to buy this. I just want to say, Retro Gamer is the last magazine that I receive in magazine form, which feels like a crazy sentence that wow. To put out in the world. But like for me, I'm like, I absolutely look forward to when it does arrive, opening it up. And some people say to me, you know, you can get these online. I'm like, yeah, you can get music in MP3, but still, people still buy vinyl. So it's a similar thing to me.
Well, thank you. I would say it's one of those things. I think one of the reasons we're fortunate is that people buy Retro Gamer as a magazine because it's a magazine. You know, when you're reading about, it's not exclusively nostalgia, but when you're reading about nostalgic things, you kind of want to read it in the media with which you grew up, right?
Okay, so Nick, we'd like to do an introductory question on this podcast. So we recently put out the Dreamcast Junkyard's top 200 Dreamcast games, which was voted for by the community. People have had opinions about it, and obviously our defence is, it was the community, it was not us. We did not make this list, you know, because there are some pretty odd lists out there on some websites that people are scratching their heads at. But this one is the community, so we cannot say that it is wrong. It is the definitive list. But we just wanted to ask you a few questions about it. So one of the questions was, what's the highest ranked game in the list that you haven't played but would really like to?
It's really high. It's number 5, Skies of Arcadia.
Oh, okay. So have you never dabbled with Skies of Arcadia at all?
No. So I never came across it in the wild back in the day. I just never found a copy. And then when I finally did, obviously it had become a bit expensive by that point. And I was kind of going through a period of not playing many RPGs. I just didn't feel like I could make the time commitment that they typically demand. But in the last couple of years, I kind of got back into the genre, especially via the Sakura Wars series. So between getting back into the genre and Vice and Ica being kind of crucial in my Valkyria Chronicles squad,
yeah,
that's one that I really want to play.
Just to help you feel slightly less guilty there, Nick, last time we did the top 200 vote, which was 7 years ago, I came up with an idea in our back end. I was like, everyone should pick the highest ranked game that they've never played, play it and write about it. And mine's was also Skies of Arcadia. And people at home will be like, I never remember reading Kev's thoughts on that. That's because I still never played it, even though it's been 7 years. So I was like, I'm going to make a mental note now. Must play Skies of Arcadia.
Yeah, it is worth it, and you'll love it when you get a chance. You know, the Dreamcast didn't have that many RPGs, unfortunately, especially like the Western releases, but that game gets the praise it deserves for sure. It's not just a case of it was the best we had. It is genuinely fantastic. It's definitely one that needs to be put out on modern platforms, because the Dreamcast version's getting up there and the GameCube version was always expensive for some reason. So yeah, it's a harder one to get hold of now, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think especially with the passing of Rieko Kodama last year.
Of course, yeah.
It would be a nice tribute to her if Skies of Arcadia could make a comeback, I think.
Yeah, you heard it here, Sega. I mean, I still am hanging on to this like one guy. I think it was like around 2010, and he said in like, he was a Sega guy, he probably doesn't even work there anymore, and he said, the fans really want us to re-release Skies of Arcadia, and they've never done it since. So yeah, still waiting for him. So the other question we had about the top 200, this is the controversial one: which game on the list do you feel is too high?
Okay, so I will open by saying that I like this game, and I used to own this game. I think it is a good game. I just think that it's fairly high up relative to other games that I feel are better.
Okay.
And that is Cannon Spike.
Okay, okay.
Unfortunately, I sold off my copy when I was in desperate need of money a little while back. When I say a little while back, I mean some years back now. But I kind of wonder if the money aspect of it is something that's made it that high, if people ranked it highly kind of to justify their own investment in it. Because it's a good game, but that high?
Yeah, it's kind of like that, what's it called, like sunk cost fallacy, where it's like you kind of boost something up because, you know, because if I spent the amount of money that the Cannon Spike demands, I would like be probably in my head would start thinking like, this is the best game ever, and for me, I think it's an all right game. And I think maybe because there's a lot better Capcom output on the Dreamcast, I think that kind of makes it lower for me. But yeah, I definitely get what you're saying with that. Have you played Cannon Spike, Kev?
I have, yeah. So just for anyone listening at home, it is number 39. So I do like Cannon Spike, but I feel like I must have mentioned this several times. At no stage between 1999 or whenever it came out and 2014 did anyone ever mention that game to me in any shape or form. And it seems to have become, like you say, it feels like it's synonymous with a Dreamcast, even though it wasn't. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
and I think actually that's a good point, because like it's one of like, and this is a point that I make in the feature, if you look at the top 30 games in that list, like all but about two of them can be found on other platforms. So Cannon Spike being a proper Dreamcast exclusive probably elevates it as well.
And then finally, Nick, we had our last question was, which game on the list do you feel is too low?
So I had a few different candidates for this one, but the one that I've gone for is Guilty Gear X.
Okay, yeah.
Now, I kind of get it because, like, there are a lot of 2D fighting games on the Dreamcast. There are a lot of fighting games in general. So there's some pretty fierce competition. But that game is still striking to look at today. The music is amazing. It plays really well. And it only reaches 140th. Like, it doesn't clear Mortal Kombat Gold. Really?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. and I think, you know, maybe that's because it was only released in Japan. But yeah, that one baffles me.
Yeah, quite amusingly, the developers Retro Summer, so the indie developers who made Xenocider, you know, we sent them the list and said, hey, guys, like, you know, Xenocider made the list at quite a good spot. And they replied, like obviously we're flattered, but what? Like, our game beat Guilty Gear X? Like, what's going on? This is crazy. Like, they were completely just baffled by, like, the placement over that. And, you know, Gunlord as well was another one that they were saying, what? How did we get above Gunlord? So, yeah, that was really, really funny response from them. But, you know, it's good to see the indie stuff making its place on there as well. Mm.
Did you have anything, Nick, that you're fond of that isn't on the list, which I asked for my own failed interests? Like, I voted for NBA Showtime and I also voted for Dave Mirror, both of which are in the didn't make the list at rankings.
So there's a couple. The one that stands out to me, and I know that it probably shouldn't make the list because it's not a brilliant game, but I'm irrationally fond of it, is Heavy Metal Geomatrix.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I don't even think it's so much about the gameplay as just that game sold me a number of albums. But yeah, it's very much a direct arcade translation with not loads to it. And it's kind of a little bit janky, but yeah, I love the aesthetic more than I love the game. But given some of the stuff that did make it, I was sad not to see it there.
Yep. So the next question then, Nick, is what's your history with the Dreamcast then? When did you get the system and what were your first thoughts on it?
So my history with the system sort of actually goes way back to over a couple of years before I ended up getting it, because I was sort of avidly reading multi-format games magazines in late 98 because I had a Mega Drive at the time and I was sort of looking to get a new system. And it was a really exciting time because you, like, look back through those mags and you've got previews of games like Metal Gear Solid and Spyro and F-Zero X and Ocarina of Time. And then there was quirkier stuff like Pocket Fighter and like import reviews of Radiant Silvergun. So it was a really exciting time. And I was always a Sega kid. Like, the first console that was bought was a Master System. My dad had a Mega Drive and then I got one of my own. I hadn't got Saturn, partially because it was expensive and partially because we didn't have much, you know, we were kind of behind the times with consoles. It's funny, I remember sort of thinking, well, maybe if we can't afford a PlayStation, maybe, like, the Saturn is cheap now and I could get a console that does 3D games. Anyway, looking through these magazines, I started seeing hype for a new Sega machine. And I can remember the exact spread of the exact magazine that sold the console to me. Mentally, at least, not in cash terms. So in issue 205 of Computer and Video Games, there's a spread with Virtua Fighter 3 TB on one side and Sonic Adventure on the other side. And Virtua Fighter 3 TB was my favourite arcade game at that time. Sonic Adventure was the return of my favourite character. And it's like, right. And then that Christmas, I got a PlayStation, which you know, the Dreamcast had only just come out in Japan. You know, we were still nearly a year away from getting it. You know, the PlayStation is a great system. I was immensely grateful for my parents for teaming up to get that for me. But then as I was playing and enjoying that, I started seeing more hype for the system ahead of its Western launch. And the first encounter I had with the Dreamcast was Demopod at Toys R Us running the E3 demo of Sonic Adventure. And I stayed there for probably about half an hour and really, really annoyed a lot of other kids. But yeah, so I was 13 when the system launched. Couldn't afford it myself. And I just got a PlayStation the previous year. There was no way that I was going to get another new console. At least not a not an expensive home console. I got a Game Boy Color that Christmas with Pokemon, which I loved.
That is a good present, to be fair.
Yeah, so love that. So a lot of my experience with the Dreamcast was kind of from a distance during its lifespan. So like I'd go into places like Virgin and like the local cinema where they had demo pods playing games like Trick Style, Ready to Rumble, Echo. I think it was either Curry's or Dixon's had Soul Calibur. And then we had an arcade in the local shopping centre, Sega Park. And in there, we'd get games, obviously with the Naomi being based on the Dreamcast architecture. We'd get a lot of games where I'd go in and I think, when I get a Dreamcast, I'm going to get this game. And that was stuff like they had Crazy Taxi right in the entrance, Virtua Tennis, WWF Royal Rumble I really enjoyed. I know not everyone loves that, but
Kev has stuff to say about that, yeah.
In the arcade, it was a good time. Confidential Mission. Didn't get on with everything. Like, I bounced off F355 Challenge because I found it too hard.
Mm.
And like a pound ago, it was like, well, I'm going to play something else. Capcom versus SNK, I didn't get on with initially because of the ratio system. Like, I found Sakura, one of my favorite characters, which is too weak. And then House of the Dead 2 just had too many zombies, and I don't like zombies. I had a traumatic experience at Halloween party as a kid. So that was kind of how I got the experience, because I didn't know many Dreamcast owners. My cousin had one, but he was off at uni. A couple of guys at school that I was kind of friendly with, but not really so much, had them. And so it wasn't actually until after the system was discontinued that I got it. And I can remember watching a news report on it, and they were using footage of Jet Set Radio to illustrate the story. And it was like, how has it come to this? Like, this looks like the best thing ever. Yeah. Like, my the company that, you know, got me into gaming isn't making consoles anymore. But it, obviously, I don't want to frame it as a blessing, because, like, lots of people lost their jobs, right? It had a real human impact, the commercial failure of the system. But yeah, what it did do was it made it affordable for a family like us. And I sold it to my mum as an investment in my future, because we couldn't afford a PC. And I said, well, like, a Dreamcast now is like 1/10 of the cost of a PC, and that would give us access to the internet. That would really help with my homework, you know.
That is very smart.
My mum never had a problem with gaming stuff. She's always been very supportive of my hobbies, which I'm immensely thankful for. But, like, convincing her to spend on something that wasn't technically necessary when we didn't have loads was, you know, I mean, I did use it for homework, and actually the whole thing kind of backfired on me a little bit, because my younger sister would end up having the right to kick me off of a game if she needed to use it for homework.
Oh.
So, slight tactical error, but I got a Dreamcast, and that was where it started. So I was around for the sort of last year or so of commercial releases in the UK. So, like, you know, I remember being hyped for things like Headhunter and Virtua Tennis 2 and Rez. But yeah, so that's kind of how I got into it. Sold my mum on internet access.
You worked into Sega's own marketing, because that was how they were selling it in Japan, wasn't it? So
yeah.
I know Lewis is a bit younger than myself, but I never played on one of those, the demo pods, but one of our staff team has one in his house. And he sometimes posts, it's one of the Jameses we have. He sometimes posts up photos for it. And I always think, this is maybe, other than the divers, this is like one of the most envious I am of any type of Dreamcast item.
Oh yeah, it's a bit of a grail for sure. Like I would love to own one, but also I have to face the reality of, you know, the space that I have in a one bedroom flat, right? But the thing with those demo pods was they were a bit flaky. Like I remember often coming up to them, they'd be switched off because the system had overheated or something.
The Dreamcast itself is always a bit flaky, I guess. So it kind of,
well, yeah. I mean, I've had to do surgery on mine a number of times, but it's still going, bless it.
Is your original one still, is it still going, or has it been replaced since?
So it is the original one, but I recently had to swap out the GD-ROM drive because that had stopped reading discs.
Oh, bummer. Yeah. But
other than that, it's still going strong.
And we've got another question here, but you've kind of answered this. So you obviously used your Dreamcast online, but did you ever play online, or were you maybe a bit too young for that? Or
so I did play online. Like I probably used it more for web browsing than I did for online gaming, because I didn't have many online games. So the one that I played most at the time was Choo Choo Rocket. I also spent a fair amount of time in like Dream Arena chat, and I can remember ridiculous things going on, like some guy just posting the lyrics line by line for 21 seconds by So Solid Crew. And another dude who... Do you remember back in the day you used to get, like, not in a catfishy way, but people who would just go on message boards and pretend to be celebrities?
Totally, yeah.
There was this one guy who was pretending to be Rob Van Dam, the at the time he'd just joined WWE. And it's like, but would Rob Van Dam be posting on a European exclusive chat room on a Dreamcast? Really?
so they were just doing it like out of for fun. They weren't trying to get your like credit card details or anything.
No, it was kind of role playing, I guess.
Right.
But like, so I played Choo Choo Rocket. I enjoyed downloading other people's puzzles. Played a little bit of F355, which is an odd one because it's obviously more like competitive time trials than an actual race.
So you obviously got over the initial frustration with it at the arcade and enjoyed it on the Dreamcast then.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I really credit the Dreamcast for, is allowing me to spend some time with games that I might, if I bounced off them and didn't feel like spending a pound a go to kind of get it, then the Dreamcast was there to sort of let me spend time with them without the sort of ongoing financial drain.
Yeah.
And then Phantasy Star Online came a bit later. I didn't get it for a while, but I can remember just running around with this French dude at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was fantastic.
So I've got this lovely image of you shouting at your sister, you can't do your homework now, I'm playing PSO with Rob Van Dam.
Do you know what? The shouting was more on my mum's side of things, because apart from the fact that I had to run a cable right through the house to my bedroom.
Yeah, and they never showed that in the adverts, did they?
They did not.
So I'll be able to go on the internet, mum, once we get out the 17-meter cable.
But also, obviously, I blocked up the phone line while I was doing it and ran up some pretty hefty bills, which, funnily enough, buying the Dreamcast was what convinced my mum that we actually needed a PC, and also convinced her to become an early adopter of broadband just for the flat rate charges, because she kind of figured that the internet was no fad. It wasn't something we were just going to get bored of and drop.
It's one of those wild things, thinking back to that, the idea that there wasn't flat rate pricing on internet usage in the UK, least in the UK. So,
I mean, when I got my system set back up, because I have DreamPie now, I still get online when I can. One of the things that I'd completely forgotten was that there was a little, on DreamKey, there was a little connection timer in the corner to show you how long you'd been online, because that used to be a real concern.
Yeah, totally. Not Dreamcast related, but during this kind of era, I was like 15, 16, 17, I was really into Team Fortress Classic, the mod, as it was then. This is pre-Steam. And I remember, like, sometimes we'd start a clan match in, like, the Demon UK Serious Ladder League before 6 p.m. And so we, like, you'd be sat waiting thinking, oh, like, at the minute, there's only two of us on because no one else can afford to come on before 6 p.m. So just hold the flag till the rest of the team are allowed to come on. And it's just like, if you tried to explain that to a kid nowadays, they just shrugged their shoulders at you as they continued looking at their 900 tabs of TikTok that they're watching consecutively. So,
oh yeah, and I mean the other thing that people forget is that like up until DreamKey 3 came out, you couldn't even choose your ISP. Like you were stuck with BT and whatever they wanted to charge you.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So you played Phantasy Star. Mm-hmm. So have you been back on that? Because you mentioned that you have a Dream Pi.
Yeah. So at some point, my old save got corrupted. I think I'd made the mistake of storing it on the same VMU as an MSR save, and I was playing the bugged version. So I did go on there just the other day to get a screenshot for the mag to show off the communication features, and obviously they were really ahead of their time. Mm. But yeah, I've just started a new save, and I'm all set up to go. So if anyone wants to walk through and relive the adventure, please let me know.
So I love hearing your stories on that, Nick, though, because somewhere on one of the many VMUs that I've now accumulated, I have got my original Dream Arena settings that's got my, like, if you go over it, it shows you, like, I can't remember if it's your username or if it's your email address, but I'm just like, I can't bring myself to delete them. And it's one of the reasons I hate buying pre-owned VMUs, because I don't like deleting people's saves, or like, especially if they've got a PSO save on there, I'm a bit like, oh, I'm deleting someone's childhood here.
Yeah, man, it's like, you know, they don't want it back, but at the same time you don't want to destroy it.
Yes, totally. Yeah. And we like to play it, well, I say we, I like to play, much probably to the distaste of everyone else. If I ever get a new VMU, I'll always put a post up on Twitter. It's the only time I ever log into our account to help Lewis and the team out, with what I call VMU bingo. So I'm being like, I've just bought a VMU, there's 7 games on it, have a guess if you think you know what titles they could be. And there'll always be people like Crazy Taxi. It's like, nope, no Crazy Taxi on this one. But yeah, it's I don't know, it's quite an endearing thing, isn't it, to kind of look through, like, well, what, I own these 7 games, what did this person that owned this owned? So
yeah, that's always fascinating. I mean, recently our production editor, Tim, sent me his old PS2 and he bundled his memory card in with it. And it was just fascinating to look at some of the things that he was playing. Probably the most surprising one was Drakengard. But yeah, it's fun when it's someone you don't know. I think it's almost more fun if it's someone you do know.
Yeah, I've done that. I've literally sat with my friend, like I brought my memory card around. We put it as PS2. Sorry, I can't talk about PS2 this much on a Dreamcast podcast, but we just sat there and like we went through each other's memory cards. Like, oh, you played that game? I never knew you played that. I'd not played it, so I was like, what do you think of it? He's like, oh yeah, it was good. Yeah, it was like quite fun, like looking through all the little icons. So yeah, it's kind of a it sounds a bit sad, really, but it was fun at the time.
No, I get it.
You mentioned before you'd wrote for those 3 different magazines. Could you give us a bit of a background of how you came to work for Retro Gamer, including you used to write your own fan site? Is that your first experience of writing?
Yeah. So 20 years ago, in 2003, I started a Dreamcast fan site, which was at dreamcast-lives.tk. And it was obviously slightly after the system had been discontinued, still obviously receiving new games. And to me, it felt like a great injustice that the console had met its early demise. And I was just really keen to alert people to the fact that there's this system where you can pick up games that really would rival anything on the PS2, GameCube or Xbox. And you could pick these games up for a song at that time. So I started writing the site in January of 2003 and didn't launch it until the summer, just because I wanted to have plenty for people to read on there. And it was a small site. It got a little bit of attention just because I was reviewing import games like Border Down, Syvaria 2, things like that. I wrote most of it myself. I had some help from friends, one of whom you may have seen around Twitter, Kimimi.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, I did that for a few years.
And here's a question that was whirring away in the back of my head. When you were making your site, did you ever post to it from a Dreamcast?
By that point, I didn't. The first website that I ever did, I wrote painstakingly. I had the Dreamcast official internet guide, and that was where I learned HTML. And I had a little Sonic fan site, and I painstakingly typed out HTML using the Dreamcast controller because I didn't have a keyboard. And that was on GeoCities, of all things.
Well, GeoCities was great. Rest in peace, yeah.
Mm.
That is fantastic. It's one of those like throwbacks to the internet. Do you remember like anytime you got you signed up with an ISP, it would always come with like, you have got 200 meg of website storage? Because the idea was originally in the internet that we were all going to have our own websites or blog sites. With your site then, did you have any idea what type of like traffic or did you have the classic HTML page counter?
No, I didn't have a page counter, but on the back end of .tk, I had a hit counter that I could look at. And I cannot honestly remember what kind of figures that I was getting, but I got a steady, small but steady amount of traffic. I quite relentlessly promoted the site to the point that if you go back and look in some of the very early issues of Retro Gamer, there's a classified ad section and you will see some ads for the site in there.
Wow. I'm going to have to find those and check that out. That's awesome.
It wasn't loads, but because I was posting on places where people would have an interest, so places like Sonic Cult and Dreamcast Scene, the people that wanted to know about it would know about it. And I think I remember one time one of my articles actually got plagiarized on the Game FAQs message board, which was quite funny.
Yeah, quite a hot topic currently after that that one video that went out on YouTube. Yeah. When you were writing for your website back in the day, because you were reviewing games on what was called a dead system in the West, but you were reviewing contemporary releases. And like, obviously, I look back at something like that, and you know, when we even the Dreamcast Junkyard was around during that time, so it was technically covering a contemporary system. But like, did it feel a bit kind of sad days, like it was like sort of like a bit like it was on life support, it was on like a drip feed, or were you kind of like, yes, there's a new game, like the Dreamcast lives, you know, as the website name kind of suggests?
I was really gung-ho about it. I was really enthusiastic, and looking back, some of it's a little cringe inducing because I was very exuberant in my opinions, but every time a game came out, I was thrilled. I was very happy to get things. I mean, Border Down was the first thing that I ever imported, and I learned a harsh lesson on import tax with that one.
Oof.
But yeah, it was just, you know, people would make jokes because I would always say, well, the Dreamcast is alive, it's still getting games.
How old were you at that time, Nick, with this site?
So I would have been 16 when I launched it, so I can excuse some of the bad writing just based on the fact that I was young and inexperienced. But yeah, I was 16 when I launched it.
Very impressive. I often talk about this, but those kind of, I had no idea the Dreamcast was dead because I was still playing mine every day. But that 2002 to 2004 era existed when I was at university. So I was just kind of off in what I would call like the uni bubble. I remember like coming home from the war in like July 2004, going in Comet and being like, bro, where's all the Dreamcast stuff? like, what do you mean? Where have you been for the last 2 years? Dreamcast's gone, dude. Just falling on the floor like the guy in Platoon.
I wasn't initially aware that things were still going. And it was when Ikaruga came out and a bunch of websites kind of said, oh, there's this new Dreamcast game and it's really good. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And from there, I was kind of on the lookout. And as I said earlier, it was Border Down was the first one I imported. And then from that, I stuck with the console right to the end. Even after I'd stopped writing my website, I got pretty much most of, like, I can't remember if there were any shoot-em-ups that I missed, but I definitely got, like, Syvaria 2, Shikigami 2, Chaos Field, Redurgy, Under Defeat, Trigger Heart, Exelica, right up to Karus. And I was in my first year of uni when those last few came out, and people were like, oh, what you've got? Whenever I'd come back from the post room, I was like, new Dreamcast game. I was like, oh, an old Dreamcast game? No, a new Dreamcast game.
Were you into shooters, or did you kind of have to make yourself like shooters? Because it sounds like it was shooter heavy, those last so many releases, right?
Yeah, it definitely was. I enjoyed some as a kid. Like, I really liked R-Type on my Master System, but I definitely never played so many as I did during that period. And, you know, that was how I got a taste for it. I kind of carried that passion from the Dreamcast onto other systems.
I do get that, because I'm not really a shooter fan, but, like, since being with a Dreamcast Junkyard team, I've played both Under Defeat and Zero Gunner. And it's one of those games I'm like, I can't believe how good these look. You know, compared to some of the stuff you might have played at the time, it's like, I can imagine if you were into them, that must have been incredible getting that experience. And Ikaruga as well.
Oh, yeah.
At the time, we're a bit sneery towards like that kind of 2D or pseudo 3D perspective. But now looking back here, it's like, man, I should have tried these at least.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a bit of snottiness towards shoot 'em ups in like the games press in general at that time anyway, because... Yeah. They were seen as these very disposable games where it's like, well, you can credit feed your way through it and be done in like 20 minutes. What's the point? I was like, but if you take the time to sit down and play them and learn them and not just bash the start button every time you die, there's like a real challenge to these. So, yeah, it really developed my appreciation for the genre. And like since then, I've got PC Engine, which is obviously a brilliant system for shoot 'em ups. I've got many more Saturn games. And yeah, even like some of the PS2 stuff. So yeah, the Dreamcast really formed my appreciation for shoot 'em ups, I think. But yeah, I couldn't keep up a site on my own because I was finishing up college and moving on to university. So I kind of wound that down. Not really properly, to be fair. But I always wanted to write about games. That was always very much my passion. So while I was studying politics, I ended up just posting about arcade games on my own blog on the side. Ended up being invited to write for a site that's still going today, Arcade Heroes. Had a great time there. Got to do things like we were the first site to cover Sega Rally 3. From there, I got invited when Sonic Retro needed someone to interview Yuji Naka and Takashi Iizuka at Summer of Sonic in 2011. My name came up because I was sort of a regular around there and people knew that I did some writing. And between those experiences, when the retro gamer job came up in the summer of 2013, I thought, well, I will be honest, probably a little bit too honest here. I was actually going through a pretty bad period of depression at the time, and I applied for the job in the same way you might buy a lottery ticket.
Right, just yeah.
As a way of kind of giving myself a little bit of hope for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And, like, I thought the best that I would get out of it was, like, maybe to get on their radar to do some freelance. And, it went far better than I expected.
I mean, you told us when we were arranging this that it's your 10th year at Retro Gamer, so it definitely did work out, right?
Yeah, yeah. I celebrated my 10th anniversary a couple of weeks ago now. What, 131 issues I've done?
Wow, yeah. Were you initially the features editor, or did you, like, work your way up?
Oh, so I've worked my way up. I started off as a staff writer, and then... promoted to senior staff writer and eventually features editor. So I've been features editor since the summer of 2019, I think.
Just for anyone who's at home, what is the difference between a features editor and a staff writer? Do they differ much?
Yeah, so as a staff writer, your responsibility is just the stuff that you're writing. Once you get to features editor, there's more... involvement with the overall content of the magazine. So I work with Darren, the editor, to decide not only what gets commissioned, but the sort of things that we want to ask from our freelancers. I will now have more active role in sort of looking over and checking their work and just making edits where needed. And then I will also liaise directly with freelancers when they need things like technical help, when they have questions. And also one of my other jobs is basically to find people to write for the magazine, because we can always use new talent.
I guess take us back to when you first started. You know, were you a fan of the magazine and then you joined up, and how was it like kind of first starting to work there and like working up the ranks?
So I was a fan of the mag from almost the beginning. I missed issue one. It sold out before I could get my hands on it. So the first issue I got was issue two. And I kept reading it for years. I had a subscription while I was at university. And it was, along with Edge and Games TM, one of the few mags that I would buy. It was funny, when I was interviewing for the job, like, the people that were interviewing me, like, obviously I'd been reading Darren's stuff in Retro Gamer and Games TM for years. I'd actually met him before at the Classic Gaming Expo UK in 2005, and he offered me Panzer Dragoon Saga for 50 quid, and I didn't buy it because that was my whole budget for the day. And we both express severe regrets over that day. For not buying the game and him for selling it.
Yeah.
And then the editor-in-chief at the time was Nick Roberts, who genuinely had been writing about games since I was a baby. Like, he wrote for Crash. He was the editor of Sega Master Force and all sorts of things, up to working on Dreamcast magazine at Paragon.
Mm.
And then Damien Butt, who was the managing director, had worked on Sega Pro and things in the past. So, like, I came in knowing a lot more about the people interviewing me than they knew about me. So, yeah, I got the job. I moved down to Bournemouth in November 2013. And it was very exciting because at the time, there was still a reasonably sized games department in Imagine Publishing. So you had Games TM, X1, which had just rebranded, Play, and the website NowGamer. And this was the time when the PS4 and Xbox One had literally just come out. And my first job was to review an Xbox One game, Killer Instinct.
So that was it only had eight fighters, didn't it? Or you could get it free.
Six, yeah, that was it. So, like, I gave it 72%, and I was joking with, Darren was joking with me the other day, like, you know, I don't think people are ready for your 10-page feature on that game. And it's like, it's a joke, but it's such a different game to what it was when I reviewed it. It probably does warrant revisiting in some fashion.
Mm.
But yeah, so the first feature I wrote was the Bluffer's Guide to Arcade Racing Games, which amazingly ended up being the cover feature. It came down to that or a feature on Activision, and they went with the Arcade Racers one. So I was very pleased to get the cover on my first issue.
That was the good choice as well, I think, over Activision.
Yeah, I mean, it was like old school Activision with like the Rainbow Trail art from the Atari 2600 games and stuff. It was a nice cover. Yeah. It's a shame we never got to use it. But it was a lot of fun getting to know people, because like in my previous job, I was working in IT and event management, which is a weird combination, but we had a high-tech meeting venue at the university. And the people that I was working with were all event management people, and they were lovely, but we had nothing in common. And moving to Imagine, like, I was living in a much smaller place, I was earning less, I actually took a pay cut to take the job. And I couldn't have been happier, because I was with my people, people who love games as much as I did, right? Like, I remember in the early days playing fighting games, things like King of Fighters 13 and Virtua Fighter 5 Final Showdown with Ryan King, who now works at Sega, and Luke Albiges, who was the editor of Play at the time. And, you know, the whole department would go out on payday for a meal together. It was really a lot of fun. The other thing about my early days on the mag was that they were a bit turbulent, because well, the first two issues went fine, and then the third one, Darren got ill and had to go to hospital. And then pretty much as soon as he came back, I had to take a couple of weeks off to go look after my mum, who had had a heart attack. The first few issues were really turbulent, and then things started to settle down a bit more with the Crazy Taxi issue, which was one of my favourite ever ones to do. It's like my first trip out of the office to go do an interview. It was with Kenji Kano, Crazy Taxi Games. Our photographer James came along and got some really great photos of him, like pretending to hail a cab and things.
Mm.
And the best bit was I actually brought my Dreamcast along with my copies of Crazy Taxi 1 and 2 so that we could get some shots of him playing the game. And not only did he play it, but he was fantastic. He like remembered where all of the oddly placed passengers were and stuff. It was a lot of fun to watch him play. So, yeah, that was kind of the initiation. And then kind of took me a while, I think, to really properly get what I was doing. So, like, the lifeblood of Retro Gamer is interviews. It's the people that we talk to. Our job is to tell their stories, I feel, a lot of the time. But I hadn't really got that point. And I'd also come from writing online where I had, like, no real deadlines or word counts to hit. So there was definitely an adjustment process to it. We got settled in eventually and, like, you know, very good friends with Darren. Like, he's, you know, he's my boss, but he's someone that I enjoy hanging out with. And I think that's one of the things that really made an impression on me early on, is that everyone involved with Retro Gamer cares about the subject matter. And that's that was true, like, true then as it is today. Everyone going up the chain who has direct involvement with the mag has been around games for a long time and will have opinions, like, because back then it was Aaron Asadi, who used to work on Play, and Damien Butt, who I mentioned earlier. And today that will be Tony Mott, who is the editor-in-chief of Edge and editorial director for Games Mags at Future. And he's been writing about games since the Super Play era. So,
wow, yeah. I'm always very jealous when I hear any type of mag talk of just like the culture of being with other people who know about games and playing games with them. And I think, like, I think that dates back, and I've heard Lewis talk about this, to like my love of the Dreamcast comes from playing it in my bedroom with my sixth form mates who I'm still friends with, but like don't live anywhere near anymore. It's just that type of, like, I don't know, like camaraderie. That makes it sound a bit kind of art house, but you get, like, I'm never jealous of like the press trips or the free stuff, but the idea of spending lunchtime playing Crazy Taxi or Soul Calibur with someone, I'm like, man, that must be amazing.
Oh yeah, I mean, like, that was one of the really cool things. Like, one of my colleagues, Adam Barnes, who still writes for the mag now as a freelancer, he'd just got a Mega Drive and had it in the office, so we'd play Micro Machines and Skitchin at lunchtime. Like, I had my multi-tap in and brought in NBA Jam Tournament Edition. But the unfortunate thing about it is that, obviously, you know, there aren't many games mags around now, and I was kind of around to witness the decline of the department over the years. So, like, in 2015, X1 was closed, and then Play followed the next year. And then I remember it was an awful day in 2018 when we learned that GamesTM and GamesMaster were going, because it left Retro Gamer as, like, the only games mag left in the office. GamesMaster being in Bath, obviously, but GamesTM, that team sat next to us. So it's something that I miss, because it, you know, the business has changed a lot over the last 10 years. But in terms of what we do on the mag, not so much. Like, you know, there's been events, like we got bought out by Future in 2016. And there were worries at the time, I think, with some of the fans, but it's been nothing but a good experience as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's that. I think, I feel like with the magazine being a magazine and with it being about retro games, there's that perfect marriage, isn't there, of like, The fans, I imagine, of this magazine wanted to be a magazine, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you grew up reading about games in magazines, it's a nostalgic format combined with nostalgic content. And I think that is what puts it over the top for a lot of people. And, you know, I think that's why you see a lot of the other retro game magazines that have sprung up in the last few years. And there have been some really good ones. Like, I am gutted that Sega Powered appears to have ceased, because I thought that was really good. Like, obviously it had Dean and Neil, who had history with Sega magazines themselves, and the professionalism showed through. You look at things like Amiga Addict and Pixel Addict, and, you know, Crash and Zap have been revived. there's definitely a love for print in retro gaming that I think is probably comparable to the love of vinyl among serious people who are serious about their music, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. The last time myself and Lewis were together in person was the Nottingham. What was the full name of this, Lewis? I'm so bad with names.
Notts VGE, Nottingham Video Game Expo, I think it is.
Which is coming back this year, and we will be out in some form. But we were next to the Amiga Addict guys. And then there was the Sega Powered Mag store there. And like one of the first things I bought was about four copies of Amiga Addict and a decent stack of the Sega Powered stuff that are upstairs on the Kallax in our living room. So that shows you the weight that they carry with me. So.
Obviously, the big reason why you're here, Nick, is that there is a special issue of Retro Gamer coming out, and that is coming out on the 21st of December.
Yep.
What can everyone expect, and what is included? What you've been up to as far as getting it ready? Like, give us everything.
Yeah. So, funnily enough, it goes back to last year, late last year. We talked about doing a Dreamcast cover, just because the Dreamcast is really good and we thought it would be popular. And then I sort of made some initial contact with people and realized, well, hang on a minute, the 25th anniversary is next year and we have other strong things that are probably more timely this year, so why don't we put it back a bit? And so it all started coming together again, I think probably about 8 weeks ago we decided to do it, and 6 weeks ago things started really rolling in earnest. And the idea was that we would celebrate the Dreamcast's 25th anniversary, but we would also, me being sort of part of the scene for all of these years, I've followed the homebrew side of things. You know, I've been reviewing the new releases in the mag that have come out via the indie scene. And I thought it would be nice to not only sort of say, well, weren't all of these games like Jet Set Radio and Sega Bass Fishing and everything great, but also say, look, there's still great stuff happening in the Dreamcast scene. You know, there are a lot of people doing really cool work. And in the same way that the console ignited my passion for writing about games, it's kind of stoked the same passion in people who create around the Dreamcast now. So I got in touch with a number of interviewees. So talked to Martin Chudley, who was the head of Bizarre Creations, developer of Metropolis Street Racer and Fur Fighters.
Nice.
And that's obviously more of a historical aspect of what it was like to work on the system back in the day. Jörg Tittel, who during the Dreamcast heyday was writing for the official mag in the US, and his company, Rapid Eye Move, has worked with Wolf and Wood this year to create C-Smash VRS, the VR successor to Cosmic Smash.
Yeah, he was also in Illbleed as a character, wasn't he?
He is, yes.
Yeah.
We spoke to Mike Tucker, who is of Bitmap Bureau, the developers of Xenocrisis, which is a brilliant game across a number of formats, but also the Dreamcast. Daniel Crocker, Wave Game Studios, very prolific Dreamcast indie publisher today. Mm. James Toccio, who creates under the name GG Dreamcast, does video stuff and writing. And I didn't know this. I sort of missed it on the credit screen, but he worked on the Cool Cool Toon translation patch.
Yes, yeah.
And leading on from that, Derek Pascarella, who's obviously a programmer who has done mods like Cool Cool Toon, Nakaruru, Sakura Wars columns too. So we talked to him about doing those.
Friend of the show.
Yeah, he was actually who pointed us in the direction of you, Nick.
Yeah.
Derek goes, oh, Nick's a great dude, like you should get him on the show. So yeah, great recommendation from Derek. Thank you, Derek.
He was a pleasure to speak to. I mean, everyone was. Luke Benstead, who is behind Dream Pie, the Simulant engine, and from that driving Strikers, really sort of a towering figure in the Dreamcast scene today. And then probably my favorite one, and it's not a name that people will be familiar with, but he's got one of the most interesting stories, is a guy called Paolo Pesani, who was a moderator on Dream Arena back in the day.
Okay.
And he talks about the inner workings of what was going on there. And it's amazing. Like, you think about how big they wanted it to be. And at, like he said, at the maximum, Sega had like 7 people moderating Dream Arena in shifts.
Wow.
That is insane to hear.
So there's some really good stories in there. You know, there's other sort of things. We've provided a list of recommended indie games for people to try, a list of websites that people should be going to if they want to keep up with the Dreamcast scene today. Obviously, Dreamcast Junkyard is one of those. And yeah, just really celebrating the system and kind of letting people know what they need to do if they want to get back into it.
You didn't happen to come across or think about or write anything, Nick, about the voice of the woman who says, this is a Dreamcast disc. Do not play it on your hi-fi, did you? Because very interestingly, for what you said about the moderators, that's right up our street, because we have had, or I say we, via Tom, our creator, we are obsessed with trying to find who that person is.
Our creator. It sounds like he's God.
Tom's a good guy. I've met Tom a number of times. And he's done some stuff for us as well. So, no, I didn't find out anything about that. I mean, I will be honest, I could probably write a whole book about the Dreamcast.
Yeah.
But originally the feature was going to be 10 pages. And on editorial deadline day, a couple of pages suddenly freed up. It was like 4:30. And I'm like, I'll take them. I'll use those for the cover feature.
Yeah.
Give me those pages.
our listeners will be very happy that you did that.
Delighted to hear that personally as well. So
yeah. I mean, you know, it was one of those things. It obviously meant that I was working well past my finish time, but I was really happy to do it because it's kind of... It's funny, on the issue that I celebrated my 10th anniversary, it's brought me full circle back to my origins in games writing about the Dreamcast. And, you know, I look back at some of the stuff I've done over the years, and I've been fortunate to meet people like Kenji Kano, like Yuji Naka. I interviewed Yu Suzuki a couple of times back in 2019. And if I could go back and tell that 16-year-old kid, like, one day you're not only going to work in print, which is kind of what you always wanted to do, but like you're going to get a Dreamcast on the front cover of a magazine.
Yeah.
to know that I'd believe me.
Them kids who are telling you to get off that that demo unit, you'd be like, get out of here, you know, I'm gonna edit this amazing feature for Retro Gamer one day.
I did say to my mum the other day, it's like, you know, thinking back, talking you into buying the Dreamcast is probably one of the best things I ever did.
That's amazing. Yeah.
But yeah, so, 12 pages, lovely cover, and the design's really nice. Andy always does a brilliant job with our visual design. And then there's actually some more Dreamcast content in the mag as well, because there's a couple of pages in the Hot Topics section where we, as a team, talk about our personal memories of the system. And you know, are a bit more personally involved, which is interesting because we get into why Darren doesn't like Shenmue.
I still have Darren's email stashed away from when I emailed him about plugging our top 200 vote. So depending on what he says about that, I might be firing another email his way. Like, how dare you? That forklift scene is beloved.
To be fair, I do actually reference the top 200 in the feature right towards the end, just sort of as part of my conclusion. So I'll leave it to you guys to see how that
Imagine it's something like, regardless of the high placing of Spirit of Speed, the Dreamcast Junkyard can be trusted.
I have left off mentioning that, but by God.
We're still convinced our esteemed colleague James, who loves that game and sees past its flaws, rigged the vote. Because he did count the votes, you see. So maybe he kind of, you know, threw some into the pot there.
When I've been sharing that out now that it's out, I've been saying, guys, here's a list of the best 199 games plus Spirit of Speed for the Dreamcast. So, and most of them are like, what the hell's Spirit of Speed? Like, yeah. Don't never answer that question for yourself would be my own my own answer.
Yeah.
It's hard work putting a list like that together, though. Like, I did a top 150 for our 150th issue, and man, like, tabulating all of those votes and things, it's work.
And just to say as well, Nick, like, it sounds great, the feature. I'm really looking forward to reading it. And I absolutely love the fact that you've, I suppose, because you do a retro gamer, I do know you do review like new, like homebrew and that kind of stuff in the magazine. But I absolutely love the fact that you've really focused in on that current Dreamcast scene, because every month someone will tweet at us and be so surprised that this console's still going, you know, it's going strong to this day.
Yeah, I mean, there was a point that Daniel Crocker of Wave made in the feature, and he says there are people who say that the Dreamcast is still a current gen console because it never stopped getting games.
Yeah.
And you can see it. I mean, because I kept going back in the day, like after Karus came out, I bought things like Wind and Water, which I think is a great puzzle game. Obviously was aware of things like Sturmwind and that as they came along. And what's interesting is that I think the Dreamcast scene is producing the best indie games that it ever has.
Yeah.
You look at stuff like Intrepid Izzy is fantastic. Xenocrisis, even though it's a conversion of a Mega Drive game, is like ideally suited to the Dreamcast, I think, in terms of the controls.
Yeah.
And stuff like, you know, Driving Strikers, who would have guessed that we'd get a new online game in 2023?
It's mind-blowing, it's isn't it? Yeah.
Now, we did mention the top 200, but we got a question for you here, Nick. Mm. What are your top three Dreamcast games? If you have four, feel free to say four, Nick, because we have shoehorned you into a specific number there.
Okay. Shenmue 2. So after secondary school, I took on some jobs. I didn't go to college. Took on some jobs and didn't really have a great time with it. Decided to go back to college. And then in the in-between time, I kind of ended up living this odd nocturnal life. I would spend all night playing Shenmue 2, and I got that one before I got the original. So it blew me away. It looked incredible. The scale of it just was like nothing else. And as I later discovered, I think the pacing is a bit quicker and more to my taste than the first game. And obviously you still have the freedom to explore at your leisure and things. And like, you know, it's a great retro compilation in its own right as well. But like, just nights of playing Lucky Hit or wandering. Like, I remember the streets of, or Shenmue's versions of the streets of Wan Chai and Kowloon as if I'd visited them myself. And, you know, there are so many brilliant set pieces in that game. Like, when you're being chased through the building, when you're handcuffed to Ren, or when you're being attacked with a chainsaw. Like, just an amazing, amazing game. Absolutely love it. I think, like, it's not only, I would say, my favorite Dreamcast game, but one of my favorite games ever. And the same goes for Rez. So one of the reasons that I love the Dreamcast is that I was kind of starting to crave more novel experiences in my games around that time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it had gone from 2D to 3D, and there was that initial rush, but then you kind of think, well, you know, it's another platform game, it's another shoot 'em up, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Rez just looked so different to anything else, and the way it sounded was so different to anything else. And, you know, underneath it all, it's an arcade style lock-on rail shooter, but then I love arcade games. And coupled with that presentation, I mean, it hasn't aged a day because it's abstract and it's not shooting for realism. I mean, proof is in the pudding. You look at it on PS4 on Res Infinite and it looks just as great today as it did back then. And it's another one of those ones that sold me CDs. I just, Area 5 in particular, where you go through the sort of evolutionary journey of mankind. Oh boy, that was an experience. So yeah, Res, very special game to me. And then the third one, and I kind of hinted at this earlier, Sonic Adventure. So I used to favor Sonic Adventure 2 over the first game. But over time, I kind of came to appreciate the original more because the scale and ambition of it are really quite impressive. And I think people tend to forget that this was a game that was, because obviously it came out again like 5 years later on the GameCube, people compare it to things like Super Mario Sunshine, and really it's a game of the era of Banjo-Kazooie, right? And it's just got so many brilliant little moments that don't get mentioned a lot, but like when Zero smashes the video wall to get to Amy, or like E-102 battling his way up the moving trains, or when you've got Knuckles in Skydeck and you're tilting the whole stage to move things around. And Sonic Adventure 2, for all of its visual polish and high frame rate and everything, doesn't have anything quite that imaginative going on. So between that and the fact that Sonic Adventure features the best character in all of video gaming history in Big, love it.
Yeah.
I'd say, since you asked for four, if I get an honourable mention, then like Soul Calibur is a fantastic game. It still looks great. It still plays great. You know, and I remember many happy nights of setting life bars to infinite and trying to win via sumo rules of forcing each other out of the ring.
Love it. That's a great four games there. What do you think, Kev?
It is a good four games. I was worried you were going to mention my famous Res rant from whatever from whatever episode that was.
I thought about it, yeah.
I can't even remember what that was about now. At the time, one of our other staff members, Martin, was very pro-Res, and he'd picked a game. I can't even remember what it was. He picked a game that was a favourite of mine, Nick, and he trashed it on one of the episodes we'd done about things we don't like about the Dreamcast scene. So on the very previous, the very next episode, the kind of return leg, I trashed Res and I wrote a whole speech about why I didn't like it, which that, when I play it now, I feel like it was about written about a different game, even though it was only kind of 6 or 7 years ago. So I say only, but I know, Lewis, you would have liked the Shenmue 2 talk, I imagine.
Yeah, like that's one of my favorite games ever as well. And I know a lot of people obviously prefer the first one. I find it really interesting that you played 2 first. And do you think that does that form your kind of opinion of it at all? How did it feel to go back to the first one having played the second one first?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I think I might not have given the first one as much of a chance as I did based on the slow pacing of it if I hadn't known what it would develop into because of the second game.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a couple of sort of backward steps and certain things that you couldn't do in the first game that you could in the second, like just following someone to a location. But yeah, I mean, having played all three, I think 2 is the best game of the series. I mean, I have opinions on 3, but that's maybe not for now. But yeah, Shenmue 2, it was genuinely mind-blowing, and I think, obviously, it wasn't a particularly profitable venture for Sega, but in terms of advancing an art form, good God.
Yeah.
it's incredible. But that's Yu Suzuki's stuff all over, isn't it?
Definitely. I think even the fans who would say they prefer the first one will tell you, they will admit that the second one is a better game technically. You know, even if they prefer the first one, the second game just expands it and makes everything so much bigger. Like, it feels huge when you're walking around those cities.
Absolutely.
I know you finished it recently, Kev.
I did, yeah. I had the benefit of having Lewis and some of the other team help me, because at the time I'd fallen off with a lot of other people, like, oh, bloody warehouse crates, why don't they just carry them the way normal people would carry them?
Yeah.
But then Lewis was like, look, if you want to make money, why don't you just go to where the high stakes, is it Roller on Top is, and it's like down by the pit, and it's like, oh, I'd never even found. And at the time, with the Dreamcast being niche, I first tried to, like, way after, like probably about 2004, 2005, there was no one to kind of be like, oh, I'm really stuck on this bit. So having that kind of modern, oh, I'll just look up what I need to do or speak to someone who's played this before. Yeah, but I ended up really, really having started it four times and fallen off it, I absolutely loved completing it finally this year. So
that's excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if anyone ever says, like, roll it to me, I always think, roll it on top. And they're like, what? I'm like, don't just ignore me. I don't even know where that's come from. Yeah. It's like a past life in the back of my head.
See, for me, it's would you like to try a game of Lucky Hit?
Yeah, would you like to try a game of Lucky Hit? Or every year I recycle the same joke on our Twitter, which is, when I was playing that through, I snipped together the bit where you're sneaking through, and like all the people are being like, I think this is Shenmue 1, isn't it, Lewis? I'm mixing this with...
Well, where you're trying to sneak into the warehouse.
We're trying to sneak in, and everyone you see is like, you're not going any further. And I always make some lame joke, and I post out all of those little sections together. It's like, and you can always tell the Shenmue crowd, because they always respond with something else from the game.
Yeah.
You always get one person like, what bloody game is this? It's like, but I think that just adds to its kind of quaint charm, doesn't it? The slightly odd sentences or lines that the people come out with. So we've come to the part of the podcast that I am the worst at, but it's the social media outro plugs. Would you like to give us, our audience who might want to hear more of your work, or a place where they can find you, all the places they can find you?
Yeah, so I go under the username HKT3030 on Twitter and Twitch. And if you're a big Dreamcast fan and you've looked at the bottom of your Dreamcast recently, you might recognize that as the model number of a PAL Dreamcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that is the model number that will play copied discs as well, isn't it? Because everyone's always like, oh, in our community, make sure you check the model number, because some of them don't play. It's like, has anyone ever owned one of those Dreamcasts that don't play copied discs?
I've never come across one.
Yeah, I'm convinced that's a myth that's just never been fact checked properly.
Also, if I can just plug the magazine as well.
Of course.
Of course.
So on Twitter, we are retrogamer_mag. And on Facebook, we are retrogamer.uk.
And a very strange plug from me, but if you are the postman for my area of Sheffield, please will you read the sign above my postbox that says, please leave magazines in the shed, because that is specifically related to Retro Gamer, because they always jam the A4 magazine in an A5 postbox, which then makes it difficult for me to get out. I'm like, bro, this is the only piece of post I get that I care about, and you've rolled it up and fired it in something that it clearly doesn't fit in.
That's so frustrating for, like, just from us, our perspective working on the mag, it's a nightmare when you spend ages on an issue, you, like, pour your heart and soul into creating this thing, and then on the last leg of its journey to the customer, it gets, like, messed up by a dog or by the rain. It's just like, no!
Yeah, and, like, not that I'm saying it... An equal amount of work went in, but I had to make that sign, print it at work without anyone seeing, and sneak it home in my bag before putting it up waterproofed outside, because I don't own a printer anymore. I'm like, if only the Dreamcast had stayed around longer and got the Dreamcast printer that we made up for an April Fool's joke one year.
I had a good time on Tuesday, just digression, but the fact that you could shoot printers in Headhunter made me very happy.
I've never come across that, I don't think. Headhunter is another one. It's probably the second game on my list of high-ranking top 200 titles that I've never played.
That's one. I've beaten it a couple of times before, but I'm playing it again because I'm streaming it at the moment, so...
I might just check out your streams and then pretend that I've played it in the future. So
good plan.
People will be like, which button's jump, Kev? I'll be like, the jump one? It's like, right. So there's Nick's plugs for you. If you would like to get hold of us, we are on the dreamcastjunkyard.co.uk. At the minute, we're very proudly still dominating the SEO. If you type in Dreamcast and then pretty much anything else Dreamcast after that, there may come a time in the future where we don't, but it is unlikely at this stage. I feel that anyone is going to overtake us. So there's a bit of a Dreamcast Lives, Dreamcast Junkyards rivalry there, Nick. So apologies for that. We are on Twitter/X at the DC Junkyard. We are also on buymeacoffee.com/DC Junkyard. Where you can, if you're a fan of the show and you want to donate to the running costs, that you can do so there. And we are the Dreamcast Junkyard on YouTube. I believe that's right, isn't it, Lewis?
Yeah, if you just search it, it should find us. I don't know if you even know if you have, like, you do you have a username on YouTube? I think you do now.
I have absolutely no idea. Our YouTube is a fast. If you're into the Dreamcast and you're into fascinating YouTube wormholes, feel free to go give that a whirl, because Nick, it has been managed by about 9 different people who've all kind of followed the popular trends of YouTube at the time. So it starts with like people playing light gun games where they have filmed externally because there's no type of capture card. Then there's lots of like looking through stuff, and then it's moved to James and myself now. We do completely different random things. So when you look through it, you're like, man, this channel is wild. there is no consistency to any of the style, or like there's no intro, there's no outro, there's just a busy like passionate fan at the end writing about or talking about whatever they've got time to talk about. But Lewis, have we missed anything?
I just want to thank Nick for coming on. It's been a really great chat, and I am so buzzing for the issue. It comes out the day before my birthday, so that's like extra exciting.
Wow, your birthday is the day before my birthday.
Oh, nice. What, the 23rd? Is that
yeah?
Nice. Well, happy birthday for them.
Thank you, and likewise. But yeah, thank you guys for having me.
No problem. It's been a pleasure. It's just like, it's so great to talk to people about the Dreamcast and pretty much any topic, but it's been particularly great to talk to someone who's still working in print media. Everyone at home, we hope you've enjoyed this. Please, please, please check out the issue 254. You can put that on your Christmas list to you, because if you were a Dreamcast fan, you were definitely on Santa's good list.
Disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers. Please stop this disc now.